is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start with a story from the October 1985 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is That Wonderful Summer by Ron Goulart. It seemed a very traditional haunting. Midnight was always the hour when the ghostly manifestations commenced. There was always chain rattling, hollow moaning, spectral laughter. On this particular Monday evening, the Berkeley Hills were being visited by a storm. Lightning crackled, thunder rumbled, and heavy rain hit hard at the hillside Victorian mansion. Slippery wind whispered down the many lopsided chimneys, tugging at the many wooden shutters, and made them creak and whine. At about 6 minutes beyond midnight, a sheeted specter appeared beside the big four-poster bed in the shadowy master bedroom. Pointing an invisible hand, it advised in a deep, quavery voice, "Begone." Okay, that's it. Lovely Heather Redfield put aside the serious paperback novel she'd been trying to read, burying it in a sprawl of mysteries on the bedside table. "I'm walking. Not one more night do I spend in this dopey house." As the blonde young woman swung out of bed, the sheet gave an ominous chuckle and then fluttered, empty, to the thick carpet. Thunder and wind rattled the windows all around. Heather was clad in a short, lacy nightgown, and goose flesh was forming on her bare arms. Very cautiously, she approached the crumpled pink bedsheets. After watching it for a few seconds, she poked at it gingerly with her big toe. The sheet suddenly rose up, took form, and lunged at the young woman. Yelling, "Holy O'Malley!" Heather dived back into bed. Chuckling a few more times, the sheeted ghost drifted across the room. After opening the door with unseen fingers, it left the big bedroom. Heather folded her arms under her breasts. Her nostrils were flaring. Her eyes narrowed. "Out," she said very slowly and distinctly. "I want out." The pudgy man beside her sat up, rubbing at his eyes. "Hmm?" Heather gave him an elbow in the ribs. "Don't you try to flim-flam me, Rex. You weren't asleep."
"I was, Heather, honestly."
Rex Gollum yawned. "You, I take it, experienced another dummy," she elbowed him again. "Ever since you talked me into this dopey idea, ever since I was dumb enough to move into Sylvie Dahlman's old homestead and started sleeping in her dumb bed 3 long days ago, I have—"
3 days isn't one hell of a long time, Heather."
"Long enough to have been haunted 87 which ways," she said. "Spooky voices making snide remarks about not only my looks but my acting ability. Weird laughs from—"
"What's a ghost know about acting? Anybody who saw you when you were a regular on Terminal Ward last year knows you—"
"I thought you said there weren't any ghosts." Gollum shrugged.
"Okay, I'm humoring you."
He dodged the latest thrust of her elbow by rolling out of bed. "And if all that dopey stuff hasn't been enough, tonight a spook in a dippy pink sheet practically hops in bed with me." The blonde actress pointed an accusing finger. "And you, my so-called agent and my alleged lover, you tell me I didn't see a darn thing." Gollum tugged on the top of his candy-striped pajamas.
"I do love you, Heather, and I'm the best agent in the whole Shore Fine Talent Associates offices down in L.A.
So how come you let me be haunted? What kind of agent sets his clients up to be persecuted by a bunch of dopey—"
"Listen, That Wonderful Summer is your big break," the agent informed her. "A 4-part miniseries, running in prime time on a major network, and you are the star, the absolute star of the whole tortilla. You play Sylvie Dahlman herself, that tragic and brilliant authoress who blazed for a few short years and then took her life while still vibrant with youth and beauty. There's another thing. Heather snatched up the fat paper book she'd been trying to read. The Doorknob. What kind of title is that for a novel? The Doorknob happens to be a classic of American literature. In the 20 years since it was first published, it sold 7 million copies. I know, Rex. It says all that right here on the counter. She dropped the book to the table. But I've been trying for a month, ever since I was signed for this Dippy miniseries, to read my way through The Dumb Thing. I can't get beyond page 17. It's not essential. I want to understand my character. That's admirable, but you don't have to bust a... How can you truly understand a person when you can't even get any further than page 17 of his or her masterpiece without dozing off or slumping into a profound stupor? When I was on terminal ward, I understood a nymphomaniac with a drinking problem is easier to get with than... Well, we're straying from the point. Heather climbed free of the four-poster. I intend to vacate the premise. The publicity is still building on this, Heather. Gifted actress lives in house of character she's playing. He started framing headlines in the air. Heather Redfield soaks up atmosphere in long-deserted Dahlman House. Heather Redfield gets Billy Bejesus scared out of her. She went striding towards the closet. The rain continued to hit at the windows. Everybody in multi-star productions, even the old Marcus, likes the idea of your living here in Sylvie's old digs while we're up in Berkeley doing the location stuff for the wonderful summer, reminded her agent. And as for understanding her character, this very damn house is where the poor kid spent most of the 26 years of her pathetic life. This is where she penned such gems of 20th century fiction as The Doorknob, The Breadbox, The Window Shade, and other stories. Plus, I couldn't even get through the introduction on that last one. Bending gracefully from the waist, the blonde actress tugged a large tan suitcase from the closet. I conked out on page 4. Sylvie Dahlman didn't read the intro. That was Alex Mavity, same guy who did the first draft of our script and knew and loved poor Sylvie during. He's somewhat dippy, too. Writes a dopey script and gets himself hired as technical advisor. She carried the suitcase to the bed, tossed it atop the tangled spread. So he comes up here from USC or wherever to UCLA. His idea of technical advice is to tell me that Sylvie didn't wear eyeliner. You've been bitching about knowing her character, so Mavity can give you little tips like that about if you don't wear eye makeup, I photograph like little orphan Annie, she said as she yanked open the suitcase. You, in your agent capacity, ought to know that. Heather Redfield appears on the tube without eyeballs. Gollum shrugged again. Mavity's only being helpful, or trying to be, he said, glancing at the window as lightning sizzled on the wooded grounds outside. After all, he had the unfortunate romance with poor Sylvie that's the core of our miniseries, and he's the one who found her tragic body dangling from the beams down in the... Enough, Rex. I'm full up to here with morbid details. She crossed to the closet. Lou Moon's or somebody's going to have to get me a suite at a nice hotel tonight, one that's got a swimming pool and not one single darn spook. Rubbing at his chin, the agent said, you know, Heather, we might be able to exploit this ghost angle. Ghosts of past haunt rising star. I've already been written up in the National Intruder, she reminded him, when you made up that dippy yarn about my taking a ride in a UFO. You were just starting out. That was 2 long years back. So, the 10 million dimwits who read that thing think I shacked up with some little green weirdo from Mars. She bent once more and reached for a pair of her shoes. A spectral foot kicked her in the backside, sending her tumbling into the dust and shadows. Tricia Mavity caught Max Kearney's arm, her grip tight. "I really like your house here in Marin County. Come on, show me the patio." She tugged him across his wide living room in the direction of the sliding glass doors. "It's raining," Max mentioned. He was a middle-sized man in his middle 40s, dark hair short-cropped and graying at the edges. "Even so," she glanced over her shoulder to where her lean, lanky husband was sitting on the low white sofa chatting with Max's wife. "Alex, Max and I are stepping out for a bit of fresh air." Alex Mavity took off his glasses and frowned. "Don't you think it's a tad overcast? For I want to breathe as much smog-free air as I can while we're up here." The slim brunette slid the door open and pulled Max out onto the slick flagstones. "If we hunch here under the roof overhang," he said as she shut the door, "you can talk about whatever it is that's bothering you, Tricia." She took a slow, deep breath. "You're still as perceptive as you were when I worked as a copywriter at Kearney & Associates 7 years back. Pretty obvious that you're uneasy." He watched the rain hit at the twilight patio. "What do you think of Alex?" "Whoa, now, I don't give domestic advice." "No, I mean, does he look at ease?" "He looks jumpy, nearly as much as you do." "I don't know how much you know about Alex and Sylvie Dahlman." Max grinned. "Difficult not to know about them," he replied. "Most everybody's read his The Genius I Loved, Sylvie Dahlman. Sylvie Dahlman, Her Bright and Tragic Life, A Guide to Sylvie Dahlman, and now That Wonderful Summer, plus his introduction to the collected works of Sylvie Dahlman." "You left out the Sylvie Dahlman scrapbook and the yearly Sylvie Dahlman calendars." "Those too," Tricia said. "Alex has, since long before I ever met him, made a sort of cottage industry out of that woman." "Well, she wasn't a bad writer." "Hooey, Max, she was god-awful," said Alex Mavity's wife. "I write too, you know, and I can spot turgid prose and pompous." "You and Alex discuss her merits much?" "Nope. He'd consider my real opinion of that woman blasphemous," she answered. "I try, Max. I really and honestly do, not to be jealous of that woman." "Not exactly easy, but I do want this miniseries to go well. If it's a hit, the sales of all the books will shoot up," Tricia said. "Were I you, I don't think I'd be anxious to see his romance with some other lady brought to the screen," Max said. "Wouldn't you rather see them dramatize your romance with Alex?" "Oh, but I'm not a great writer, just a successful author of fat romance novels," Tricia said. "And I'm not dead. Dying young is a great publicity gimmick, especially if you leave somebody like Alex behind to tend your shrine. The sales on her god-awful novels were never much until after his The Genius I Loved came out." "His sales are pretty good, too." "They sure as heck are. And this TV thing will boost them further, making us lots of money." "Good. Now, what's the..." "You still..." "I know, because I read about your activities now and then in the newspaper. Have your sideline. What I mean is, this is some sort of occult problem, you..." "You're going to get a chill out there, Trish." Mavity had opened the glass door, was frowning out at them. "Best come back in here." "In a minute, Alex." "Now, I think." She hesitated, then went back into the living room. "I'm going to tell him, Alex." Mavity stopped in front of the deep fireplace. "I thought maybe that's what you were doing out there in the drizzle." "I was working up to it." "Trish, being the imaginative one in the family," her husband explained to Max, "tends to exaggerate." "A ghost is a ghost," said Tricia. She walked over and sat down next to the auburn-haired Jillian. "And I know whose ghost it is that's haunting the Dahlman Mansion over in Berkeley. It's only some stunt cooked up by the ape man and..." "No, Rock's Golem can't be doing all those things that are disrupting. Once the man claimed Heather slept with the crew of a flying saucer. From the pocket of his tweed jacket, he took a pipe. This latest, since Max and I aren't exactly sure what you're both so unsettled about, put in Jillian, maybe Tricia, you better fill us in. The miniseries is haunted, said Tricia. Nonsense, said Alex. It was still raining on Friday, a light, blurry rain that fell straight down on the trucks, vans, and equipment gathered on the slanting lawn in front of the three-story Dahlman house. Max, taking the morning off from his agency across the bay in San Francisco, was here to look the big Victorian house over. He parked his Mercedes 2 blocks downhill, walked up here and identified himself to one of the security guards. Now, as he started up the flagstone path towards the high, narrow wooden house, someone hailed him from amid the circle of vehicles. Max, over here, if you would. It was Alex Mavity, decked out in a black overcoat and holding a black umbrella over his head. Oughtn't you to be inside giving technical advice? He made his way across the wet grass and tangle of electric cables to Tricia's husband. They're shooting a love scene between me and Sylvie, explained Mavity. It's a very difficult thing to watch, so I stepped outside. I want to be careful you don't catch cold. Mavity said, I know you think I'm giving Trish a rough time. That's one of the reasons I wanted to... She asked me to find out how and why this production was being haunted, Max said. He wasn't sheltered by the umbrella, and rain fell on his bare head. When I phoned the director, Lou Moonstone, last night, he seconded the request. I'm as anxious as anyone to have things run smoothly, Mavity assured him, but I think Trisha's given you a false scent to follow. Oh, so? She believes the spirit of Sylvie Dahlman drove Heather Redfield from the house last weekend and has been playing disruptive pranks on the cast and crew of That Wonderful Summer ever since. You don't agree? If we're really dealing with the supernatural here, and I have my doubts, it certainly isn't the ghost of Sylvie. You've read my books. Some of them. Then you know Sylvie was a demure, sensitive young woman. Fishing out his pipe, he put it in his mouth. She didn't go in for pranks and low tricks of the sort that have been plaguing us. Death can change people. Please, Max, I really think I know Sylvie better than just about anyone. She wasn't nasty and clownish. So what's causing the troubles? Mavity puffed on the dead pipe. Poltergeists, perhaps, he answered, and don't rule out the possibility that Heather's agent may be faking. Well, yesterday, the cameraman floated nearly up to the ceiling in the library, Max said. Day before, a suit of clothes walked into a scene and danced a jig. Special effects, said Mavity. A goon like Rex Golem would be able to hire technical... Inside the house, someone started screaming. Taking his leave of Mavity, Max went sprinting into the place. In the center of the living room, a lovely blonde woman was pressing her hands to her chest and screamed. The handsome young man facing her was struggling, unsuccessfully, to pull up his pants. The pants were down around his ankles and resisting his tugging. Suddenly, the actor was flipped over, his head bonking the oriental carpet. He hung suspended in an improbable handstand until the trousers were yanked completely free. The surrounding crew, the director, and the cameraman were only now starting to move and yell. I'm not amused by this. The small, dark Lou Moonstone was scowling at the now floating pair of pants. Drifting down to the floor, the pants took shape, thrust out their seat towards the annoyed director, and then went skipping over the cables and wires on the floor. Max followed the animated trousers down the hall and into the library. I'd like to talk with you, Max told the pants. Maybe we can... From off a pile of books on the heavy, claw-footed desk, an unseen hand selected a volume. It came sailing straight at Max. He dodged, getting nicked in the ear by the cover as the book rushed by. The actor's pants now lay in a tangle on the hardwood floor. Nodding, rubbing at his ear, Max bent and picked up the book the spirit had tried to conk him with. It was a hardcover copy of Sylvie Dahlman, Her Bright and Tragic Life. Max was in his underwear, pacing his beam-ceilinged bedroom. Is the furnace dying? Jillian was already in bed. That's Stephanie's stereo you're hearing. Stereos don't make that kind of noise when they're expiring. She's playing her latest record purchase. Reaching out, Max touched the wall. It's causing the whole house to wobble off its foundation, he pointed out. Another few tracks and we'll go sliding down into the Bachman's pool. New group called Yellow Jaundice, Jillian said. Very popular with affluent 14-year-olds. Now, get back to the case. It's not a case. Only professional occult investigators work on cases, he explained as he resumed pacing. I'm an amateur, and so, in the many years we've been together, you've solved dozens of supernatural cases, Max, his wife reminded him. That makes you a pro. Quit with the modesty. Get down to details. Max crossed, sat on the edge of their bed. The Dahlman house has a resident spirit. Whose? Mavity tried to persuade me it's a poltergeist, he said, but it isn't. Sylvie Dahlman? He nodded. She's annoyed about something. Could be she doesn't want the story of her intimate romance with Alex turned into a TV show. That's part of it, Max stood, commenced pacing. After I witnessed her latest disruptive prank and poked around the house, I wandered over to the UC campus. In the English department, I found a couple people who knew Sylvie and Alex back when. Jillian watched him circling the bed. Well, what did you find out? Mavity's version of what went on between them and what Sylvie was really like may not be accurate, but he's the leading authority on Sylvie Dahlman. After she killed herself, Alex arranged with some distant kin, her parents and immediate relatives were all dead and gone, to take charge of all her papers, files, and so on, making it tough for anyone else to do a thorough book about her. Well, that's only fair, isn't it? They were lovers. According to Alex, Sylvie was a quiet, demure girl, above pranks and fooling, he said. That's not exactly how other people saw her, though, Jillian asked. What else does hers want, do you think? We'll find out tomorrow night at the Dahlman place. Max, are you going to try a seance? Yes. That could be dangerous. It could, he agreed. Thunder shook the house, rattling windows and shutters. The heavy night rain pelted the Dahlman house. Dopey, observed Heather Redfield. Listen, this might turn out to be, whispered Rex Gollum, an exploitable situation. Seances are dumb. Actress gets acting tips from ghost. That sounds. Actress fires dumb agent. Come on, Heather, play along with this and... Okay, I'm here, but don't push your luck. The actress and her agent were seated at the big round table Max had moved into the library. Also present were Lou Moonstone, the director of That Wonderful Summer, Trisha and Alex Mavity, Bosco Finn, the young actor who was playing Alex in the miniseries, and Jillian. I'm wondering, said Mavity, taking his unlit pipe out of his mouth, how wise this is, Max. It's a tried and true way of communicating with... No, I'm not talking about the nonsensical notion that anyone can actually set up a dialogue between the living and dead. What concerns me is the effect on the morale of all concerned. I agreed to attend after Trish persuaded me that this little dramatic interlude might help clear the air. Yet, I believe in what you're up to, Max, said Tricia. And despite his assumed attitude of disbelief, Alex is frightened at the possibility of, Trish, this isn't the proper setting for criticizing my... We'll start, Max informed them. Jillian left her chair, turned off the lights, and returned to the table. After lighting the three candles at the center of the table, Max instructed, Everybody hold hands. Don't be, muttered Heather. I'm going to recite a few spells and incantations, Max said. Then we'll try to contact the spirit of Sylvie. He paused, turning to watch Heather. The young actress had suddenly gone rigid. Her eyes were opened wide and staring. No need for all the crap, Kearney, she said in a new voice. I'm here. Quit futzing around, Heather, cautioned her agent. Let him get on with... Button your lip, Gollum. I don't know how long I can inhabit this bimbo's body, so let me get down to business. Jeez! The agent let go of her hand, leaning away. Max nodded at Heather. You want to talk to Alex, don't you, Sylvie? You bet I do. Now that's love, remarked Bosco Finn, coming back from the dead to... Hush up, beefcake, said Sylvie. Mavity dropped his pipe to the tabletop. The voice is vaguely like Sylvie's, granted. Not a bad job of mimicry, Heather, considering you... Stop babbling, schmuck, and listen to me, said the voice coming out of Heather Redfield. I'm Sylvie, and there are a few things I have to say to you. This is hardly the place if you are indeed my long-lost Sylvie for tender expressions. That's one of the main things we have to settle, Putz, said Sylvie. This crapola that you and I ever had some kind of thing going. Sylvie, our love has endured for... I never even liked you, Schlepp. I let you hang around because I felt sorry for you, and since you volunteered to do my typing for me. It wasn't a complete... Sylvie, being dead has changed you from... Remember what I used to tell you? You should have written paperback romances because you've got the imagination of a... I happen to be a scholar, a writer, who researches into... Alex, we never had an affair. We were never in love. We sure as hell never had a wonderful summer, or a wonderful winter, spring, or fall. We never even had a wonderful Tuesday, continued Sylvie. That's all fiction that you cooked up after I was dead and couldn't disagree. You know damn well you never turned me on, because I told you so a dozen times. The only time I even kissed you was during that damn Christmas party where I put too much rum in the punch. Very quietly, Tricia asked, Is any of this true, Alex? He had both elbows on the table and was staring across at the possessed Heather. Well, Trish, I guess... Exaggerated some. I was young when I wrote the first book about Sylvie. Young and still desperately in love with. What you've turned me into, schmuck, is a fictional character, complained Sylvie, and a second-rate one to boot. The Sylvie Dahlman in all those god-awful books is a prim, prissy dryball who... You've read my books then, Sylvie? That makes me very happy. I tried to. Yikes! Talk about verbose and clumsy. Your own prose isn't all that great, said Tricia, angry. Mavity asked, How exactly does a disembodied spirit read a... Never the special details, Schlepp. I've got a few more things to bring up. I am really pissed off at the way... Sylvie, you ought not to use language like... There you go again. You were always bitching about the way I loved you. I sensed your greatness. See, that's the kind of stuff I had to put up with from you, and I just couldn't discourage you. All the practical jokes I rigged up, you never understood, Sylvie went on. And then the last big prank I set up, well, it really got screwed up. Mavity frowned at her. What are you talking about? My so-called suicide, that was only supposed to scare you off. I decided even with the free typing, you were too much of a pain in the ass to have around, Sylvie said. The sight of me at the end of a rope and the note saying your unwanted attentions had driven me to suicide were meant to scare you off. After you'd run off, I'd climb down, have a good laugh, and hope you got the point at last. But you really were dead. Don't I know that, schmuck? What can I tell you? I must have rigged up the rope wrong. Here, I spent most of my life playing tricks on people, and then I foul up the big one. You always were somewhat clumsy, Sylvie. It was one more endearing quality. Alex, you've never mentioned that suicide note, put in his wife, not in any of your books. It really didn't seem to fit, he said. It would have hurt Sylvie's image and mine as... Screw the image, it isn't me at all, said Sylvie. And you're going to have to stop all this. No books, and sure as hell, no television opus about sweet, pure, little Sylvie. Well, how can we stop? Asked Moonstone, rising in his chair. We've already got $900,000 tied up in this, and the delays you've been causing will run the tab up to... If you don't quit, I'll keep haunting you, she warned. This is my home ground. I'm powerful enough here to... What's nodded, and said Max. It's a compromise. I don't have to give in. When you're a ghost, you... Suppose Alex agrees not to write about you anymore. Max, I'm already contracted to introduce and edit the Sylvie Dahlman notebooks for... You schlubs haven't even seen all I can do. There's an old family graveyard out back, and I might just raise up some of my relatives. There's Uncle Rodlo, a disclaimer at the start of each episode of That Wonderful Summer, said Max, explaining that the show is a work of fiction, plus a written promise from Alex that he'll keep quiet about you from now on. You, in turn, agree to quit haunting the production. Why the hell should I, Kearney? You, outside this mansion, you don't have any power. When Alex gets back to L.A., he can go on writing whatever he wants, make up all sorts of imaginary scenes of love and affection between you two. I can sure try to stop him, but you won't succeed. Your spirit is tied to this house, said Max, which is why you've never been able to reach him before this. One other thing, I'm pretty good at exorcising ghosts. Maybe I'll run you out of here, too. After a few seconds, Sylvie caused Heather to give an affirmative nod. Okay, if he puts it in writing and gives you the document to keep, Kearney. Wait now, said Alex. Everybody is taking liberties with me. Write to Alex, said his wife. Do it. But my whole career has been. That's another reason for quitting. He looked across at Heather, then away. Very well. I'll capitulate, for the sake of the rest of you, to save the production of what I know will be a memorable television. Hurry up, Schlepp, urged Sylvie. I can't hold on in this dumpy body forever. Jillian produced a sheet of paper and a pen, pushed them down the table. Use these, Alex. While Mavity wrote, Rex Gollum tapped Heather's arm and asked, Could you maybe give me a quote I can use, Miss Dahlman? About how you think Heather's doing a great job portraying you on the schmuck. Heather's body went slack all at once, and she fell forward, pretty head almost hitting the table. Mavity looked up from his writing. Sylvie? Max said. She's gone for now. She didn't even thank me, Mavity said, shaking his head slowly. I may have exaggerated the nature of our relationship, but if it hadn't been for me, her novels wouldn't have sold anywhere near as well as they did. We continue with a story from the November 1985 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Six of Swords by Gregor Hartman. I like to travel. That's good considering my line of work. When I got the proton job, I was pleased because it meant I could go to Japan. Mass transit heaven, consider. I flew in on a 747, arriving at the new Tokyo International Airport at Narita. From the terminal, I rode an electric train into Tokyo proper. That let me off at Unio Station. From there, I took a subway up to Tokyo Station, where I transferred to a bullet train. Gorgeous machines, those bullets. You cruise along the coast at 200 kilometers per hour and barely feel a vibration. In only 6 hours, I was in Hiroshima, where I spent the night. The next day, I took a streetcar to the port, where I caught a hydrofoil, out to the island of Shikoku. Shikoku's a little primitive. From the port, a bus took me around the coast to a small town. At the town, I took a ferry to yet another island, the tiniest yet, the one where the foundation said Proton was hiding. Elapsed time, Princeton to island, 47 hours, 12,000 miles in 10 transfers, leaping from machine to machine like Eliza on metal ice floes. I'm glad the Japs' machines run on time. In America, we're using the knack. Too many echoes ranting about big bad technology, not to mention traitors like Proton. The island wasn't primitive. It was Neolithic. Old wood buildings were scattered at random above a narrow beach, dropping where the tide had left them. The place had a name I couldn't pronounce, but it looked more like a fishing camp than a legitimate village. My ex-wife would have called it quaint. To me, it was a dump. The twisty lanes between houses were made of dirt and rock, and the main form of transportation seemed to be the foot. Drying squid hung on clotheslines like flat white girdles. The people looked poor. In Tokyo, everyone wore Western business clothes. Here, they were still in kimono and sandals. I felt like a time traveler from the future, tracking the renegade science through the centuries. Lunch was a bowl of rice and vegetables at a ramshackle waterfront cafe that stank of fish and seaweed. The Japanese summer was annoying. Hot, humid, thickening the space between buildings, slowing movement as if invisible gelatin filled the air. The natives didn't seem to mind, but I felt encased in plastic. Two high school kids were staring at me, so I took out the Fodor's guidebook and pretended to be a tourist. Fodor said this was the season of Ban, the Feast of the Dead, when spirits of the dead returned to visit the living. Families put out lanterns to light the way home for deceased ancestors. In the home, altars with food are set up. After 3 days of visiting, the spirits are sent back to the other world by setting adrift little lantern boots. These are small lanterns with a wooden base, so they float. On midsummer nights, Japanese streams and lakes are lined with fire, blazing with spirit ships sailing to the other shore. I slammed the book shut. Japan had some of the most advanced technology in the world. They were building computers that thought, designing their own space program. How could they tolerate this garbage? The Foundation should station some agents in Japan. It just goes to show superstition is everywhere. No matter how high we build the dikes of science, that dumb brute Aushin is there, waiting for us to relax our vigilance. For 4 centuries, we scientists have been reclaiming our lands, pumping out lies, leaching out the religious salts. Yet it waits for the ecos to drill their holes and open the gates and let it surge back in. I ran my mind over the periodic table to calm myself. It was 12:30 when I finished lunch. I planned on catching the 5:15 ferry back to civilization. Each job has its own rhythm, pace, momentum. I've done jobs where I didn't even set foot on the ground, where I flew into town, threw someone off a hotel balcony, flew out an hour later. The other extreme is to spend 2 months wheedling my way into an inner circle. Proton looked like a 2-hour job. He was wide open, the scout said. When I wandered by his house, my observation confirmed that. No protection that I could see. That made me suspicious. Proton had been a high-ranking corpo scientist before he jumped ship. He knew about security. I walked through his neighborhood, pretending to be a tourist, camera clicking like a Geiger counter. Actually, that wasn't a bad comparison. The camera was a device for scanning infrared, electromagnetic, ultrasonic. According to it, this village wasn't even electrified. The main fuel seemed to be kerosene. I came to a little graveyard which showed more signs of ancestor worship. Old women were sweeping around the stones and arranging fresh flowers. Those who weren't cleaning were chanting some garbage. Smoke from incense hung in the air like burnt flowers. If they spent all summer worshiping the dead, what did they do in winter? The whole scene gave me the creeps. Travel is hard on some people, not me. Travel helps me rise to the energy level I need to smash through barriers and zap my target. Plane to train, bus to boat, I gain energy at each transfer, like a charged particle in a linear accelerator. Each jolt pushes me closer to the speed of light till I shoot out the end of the bullet train, a bullet of infinite mass aimed at an unsuspecting proton. Not this time, not here. The island was grounding me, draining my travel buzz. Perhaps my scientific mind didn't work in this century. I visualized the actinide series of the periodic table, radioactive elements, active radio, beaming energy to me, thorium, protactium, uranium, neptunium, plutonium. His house slumped tiredly on a slight hill overlooking the Pacific. At 4:10, I went up and knocked on the door. It wasn't locked. Proton blinked at my casual sports coat, my good guy white hat. Ah, I've been expecting you. Come in, come in. I stared back at him, feeling the comforting click when a face you know from file photos matches a live one. He was about 60, wearing a blue and white kimono from which extended a thin neck. I like thin necks. Structurally, the neck is a stack of plates designed to resist gravity. Does a fine job as long as the load is vertical. But hit it from the side and see what happens. One hard punch at the third vertebra. I'm sorry. You must be confusing me with someone else, I said smoothly. Yes, yes, you're a poor lost tourist, except that no tourists ever come here. The Foundation sent you to kill me, but you're too late, he said. Really? Half listening, ears filled with adrenaline song, no one in sight. Leap forward, then knock him back into the house. Yes, I finished my work. Come in and we'll discuss it. I have a message for the Foundation. I entered cautiously, no one hiding behind the door. He made me remove my shoes and socks and put on soft slippers before I stepped onto the floors, some kind of grass mat he wanted to protect. His slippered feet hissed on the mats. The inside of his house was one large space with sliding doors to partition off areas for rooms. In one corner was an altar with cookies and rice balls, a snack for the spirits. We were alone. I waited till he sat down, then took a place a few feet away. He sat cross-legged. I squatted so I could move fast. Both eyes and instruments told me he was unarmed, but I hadn't survived this long by accepting the obvious. Strictly speaking, he should have been recycled protein by now. The Foundation didn't want Proton's message. It wanted his obit. But last-minute negotiations were within the parameters of my orders. I was wired for telemetry. Back in New York, my superiors were watching this encounter. If they decided to talk to the renegade, they'd tell me so via the speaker in my right ear. If not, I'd carry out my mission. Some tea? No, thanks. I guess you can't drink on duty. He laughed at his little joke and poured himself a cup of brown-green liquid. Bancha, cold barley tea. It's a wonderful drink on these hot days. He sipped it noisily. My work is done. Not only that, I've already mailed it off to my friends. So there's no point in killing me. Work? What have you been doing? I designed a new tarot. The man before me had once been known as Dr. Eric Nicholson, Ph.D., in nuclear physics from the University of California at Berkeley. He was visiting professor at the Nobel Institute of Physics in Stockholm, NSF senior fellow at the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen. For 20 years, he'd poked and pried at subatomic particles on the track of the elusive epsilon binding force. With no warning, no brain tumor, no divorce, no upheaval in his personal life, he'd changed his research post, changed his name to Proton, and turned mystic. He wandered from campus to campus, preaching a doctrine of matter as consciousness, of atoms as psychons in a dream of a dream. The media loved it. The stress of rapid social change was bringing out religious fanatics. You couldn't go get a pizza without tripping over an apocalyptic preacher. Proton made good copy because he had solid scientific credentials. Within a year, the foundation's social rationality index had dropped 17 points. The trustees met and decided it was time to cancel his account. A new tarot, just what we need, I said, voice heavy with irony. We can't even drill for oil without some fool babbling about raping the Earth Mother, and you lend your prestige to the tarot. The old tarot was a product of its time. That is its glory and its limit. It was created during the Middle Ages by an agricultural civilization whose highest technology was the water wheel and whose main concern was fruitful reproduction. I've designed a tarot for the scientific era, the post-atomic era. Isn't that a contradiction in terms? A scientific tarot? Shocks you, doesn't it? I had the feeling he was speaking past me to my silent monitors and past them to the trustees who would eventually view this confrontation on videotape. The condemned man speaks from the gallows, spitting at his executioners. Superstition is the enemy of science. Superstition is subjective judgment. Objectively speaking, the tarot is just a tool, an instrument sensitive to forces we don't fully understand. That's why I had to come out here on this rock facing the Pacific to develop my post-atomic tarot. There's too much interference in cities. That's why the old one works so poorly now. The air is saturated with electromagnetic radiation. The ocean grounds it out. Let's my tarot detect the subtle forces that stitch together the universe. I think science would have developed differently if our laboratories had been in isolated rural regions instead of cities. We'd still be in the Stone Age. Perhaps, he grinned impishly. Would that be so bad? Think of all the natural laws to discover. Powerful scientists lived them. I knew you were coming because the cards told me. Bullshit. Fact. You burned like a comet, roared like thunder. Yesterday you crashed into Japan and the cards trembled like seismographs. In your wake, the paddies dried up and the rice plants withered. Green tea turned black and paper fans folded because the machine man was hunting the wizard. The bastard was baiting me. Before I could respond, a tiny voice buzzed in my ear. Keep him talking. Good thinking, fellas. I'd realized that the instant he said he'd mailed off his work. To whom? An echo cell? An underground? Maybe the Foundation would want him taken alive for interrogation. The old man seemed willing to have a tea party. How about showing me those omniscient cards? I said. Proton's eyes disappeared in a nest of wrinkles when he smiled. I knew you couldn't resist. He lifted one of the grass mats and took from beneath the floor a bundle wrapped in a purple and white cloth. This is my personal set. I apologize for the crudeness of the images. I'm not an artist. He passed me the deck. The cards were rectangles of white cardboard. The images he'd chosen were a star, DNA spirals, a clock, bacteria. The four suits were earth, air, water, and fire. I ran the entire deck for the benefit of the TV camera in my sunglasses. A skyscraper, the moon, four people picking green things off a tree, a logarithmic table. In the corners were notes and mathematical symbols I didn't recognize. Even in his amateurish sketches, the juxtapositions of images and content were striking. Care for a reading? I hesitated. The cards tingled. Go ahead. They won't bite. Annoyed, I shuffled the cards haphazardly and shoved them back at him. Proton dealt out 12 in an H pattern. Then his mind sank into it, and his body was empty for a while. Despite the hocus-pocus, I shivered. I thought of electron shells, KLMNOPQ, and filled them with whirling defenders, 2, 8, 18, 32. After a few minutes, his mind resurfaced and looked out through his eyes again. The spaceship, that's you, power, speed, yet hard to touch, hard to the touch, walled off against the outside, against threatening powers. I see a man afraid of changes, who uses science and engineering as charms to protect himself from danger. The skyscraper is the tower you serve, precise, rational, heavy. But the position, you are afraid of something, someone. Speed and travel are attempts to stay in motion to avoid giving your enemy a shot at you. It is a man, a superior. I shrugged, poker-faced. No water cards. Your love life is dry, barren, scorched by the fire of your intellect, burning out of control. You're divorced? Who isn't? I glared, embarrassed that people back in New York were hearing and seeing this, sitting around a console, laughing at me. As for the future, Proton continued as if he hadn't heard, the Six of Earth, Six of Swords in the old deck, the ferryman, appropriate for a traveler, bearing you where, I wonder. He turned over a card that was face down, the black hole. With one bound, I scattered the cards and was on him, knocking him over, my arm around his throat. Is this all of the cards? Are you hiding any? Gurgles and choking. I relaxed the pressure slightly and let him gulp a mouthful of air. Yes, yes, this is all. For God's sake, I want the Foundation to see these. I want everyone to see them. The post-atomic tarot is a tool for all humanity, not just an elite. I released him. He touched his aching throat and eyed me reproachfully. I used to be like you, sick with scientific hubris, dreaming of remaking the world in my own sterile image. He shook his head. Instead, the world remade me. It's like gravity. Resist and you're pulled apart. Be fluid and your mind flows into wondrous new realms. Soggy thinking is destroying Western civilization. I've taken an oath to defend it. You're deluding yourselves. You can't kill mysticism by killing mystics any more than the church could eliminate science by killing scientists. When this sick, rotten civilization collapses, the old arts will rise from its rubble like trees breaking through a parking lot. Ha! Future generations will thank me for combining magic and science. I'm not anti-science, you know. I wish you technocratic bigots would see that I'm just pro-reality, even if that includes what you call magic. By blending science with the tarot, I'm ensuring the survival of key scientific concepts through the coming dark ages. I was only half listening. Proton was too far gone for reprogramming. No wonder the Foundation wanted him dead. If there were others to help spread his lies, it was logical to take him alive for interrogation. But the speaker in my right ear was silent. Come on, guys, make a decision. He poured himself more tea. I'll have some of that, I said. What was keeping them back in Princeton? I could imagine the arguments, the supervisors afraid to take responsibility for altering the mission. Still, leery of tricks, I chose a teacup and poured the tea myself. What makes a good physicist go mystic? I asked. Keeping an open mind. My tiredness dropped to quantum and became exhaustion. The room swirled. I tried to leap at him, but my legs wouldn't work. He looked at me sadly as I slumped to the floor. "The tea," I gasped. "The slippers," he said. "They contain Kodoryu, a paralyzing poison the fishermen use to kill sharks. You absorb it through the skin. Feet get sweaty in this climate, so it works quickly. I'm sorry I have to kill you, but you'll feel no pain." My face sagged into the floor. The mats smelled of dry grass. Gently, he removed my sunglasses. He looked into them, into the hidden camera. "And now, gentlemen, I bid you farewell." When I came to, I couldn't see. I closed my eyes. Oh my God, I'm blind. My head felt okay. Proton must have miscalculated the dosage. When I dared peek again, I realized everything looked funny because it was dark. I sprang to my feet. Next time I wouldn't be so cocky. Next time I saw the old man, I'd pop his neck like a piece of dry bamboo. The house was empty. I ran outside. My instruments and transmitter were dead, but I didn't have time to deal with that now. Fog had come in, blurring the village. No lights anywhere, but the air itself had a faint, nacreous shimmer. I stumbled over the roadstones. Pushing through the mist was like wading through oatmeal. He would try to get off the island. I headed towards the waterfront. The house's gray eyes looked on silently. No people anywhere. They'd vanished like fish when a shark swims by. Hiding from me? Fine. No one to see when I caught Proton. Fishing boats leaned on the sand. At last, some light. Torches burned in their prows. The ocean was deathly still. Far out in the mist, I saw one boat vanishing. I ran down the beach to the nearest boat. A Japanese fisherman squatted there, gray face, impassive. "I want to hire your boat." He stared off to sea, blank. "Me, go out, follow boat." I gestured, waved money, jumped in. He shrugged and slowly, dreamily, cast off. The boat had vanished in the mists in front of us, but its wake told me where it was. A series of V's rippling the glassy water, arrowheads pointing to my prey. Delta V for the connoisseur of velocity. The night was so quiet you could hear sails flapping, water splashing from our hull. Something made me look back. We were being followed by the entire fleet of boats. Torches flickered on their decks. The firelight shining through their sails made them look like great lanterns. Each boat bore the same Japanese symbol on its sail. I wondered what it meant. Despite my tension, the adrenaline in my body, I was curiously calm, aloof, light. I settled down to enjoy the chase. I like to travel. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.